Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. This program is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. Liberal democracy is in retreat worldwide, from the Philippines to Turkey to Poland, Hungary, and Brazil. In his new book, Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency, Larry Diamond argues that we're at a pivot point. Depending on what citizens do, we'll either enter a new era of tyranny or democratic renewal around the globe. Larry Diamond is a senior fellow at Stanford's Hoover Institution. Moderating the program is my co-host, Marcos Kounalakis. This broadcast is made possible each week by the generous support of Chevron, TPG, and the Draper Richards Kaplan Foundation. And now to Marcos Kounalakis.
Larry, we're joining us this evening to discuss the crisis facing democracy and what can be done about it. And he's written this book, Ill Winds, and it's a vitally important book. It is a dire warning about how democracy is threatened not only around the world, but also at home. It is also, I think, a desperate plea to save our democracies. And finally, he's not leaving us hanging. He actually has concrete actions that we can take and a plan for what it is that we can do about these crises that are facing democracy. So with that, I'm going to welcome Larry and ask you to maybe give us the bad news first and tell us why, in fact, you wrote this book.
Well, thank you, Marcos. And I also want to thank Carla for probably welcoming me here for the fourth or fifth time over the years. I do appreciate it. I wrote the book not simply because we are still in a period of what I would call democratic recession, something that I think the world entered around 2006 or 2007. And so 12 years of a democratic slump or stagnation in the world, after three decades of very inspiring progress before that, I think it is something seriously to worry about. But because I think in recent years, the democratic recession has shown signs of deepening in very concerning ways and possibly spiraling downward into a democratic depression. And of course, those involve the ill winds that I talk about in the book, the rise of illiberal, anti-immigrant, nativist, and in some cases, really ugly and authoritarian-leaning populism in Europe, I think in certain respects in the United States, and elsewhere around the world. We see a different kind of manifestation of it in the Philippines, for example, where democracy is kind of hanging by a thread. Then you've got these two international dimensions that I think have taken on, they're not entirely new, but they've taken on new energy and I think new threat in recent years. And that is the phenomenon of Russian rage, an angry, vengeful, insecure Russian Kremlin leadership trying to undermine democracy in Europe, in the United States, and split the Western alliance apart. And the phenomenon of China in a much more insidious and I think less well understood way, challenging and subverting democracy around the world. And then we can talk about as much as you want the element of American complacency, including, in my opinion, American complacency in the face of some of these trends in the United States.
Right. So you talk about this recession that has gone on for a number of years. But before that recession, there was actually an expansion, to return to these economic terms, yeah. There was an expansion of democracy after the right. fall of the wall. So why the turn?
Well, first of all, let's recall that the expansion was without precedent in the history of the world. And we went from having in the mid-1970s only about a quarter of the states in the world being democracies to around 60%. And that was a transformation in the history of the world, and we've still got probably a little more than half of all the independent states of the world, over 1 million population, being democracies. So it's not yet a cataclysm. I just fear we're creeping toward the edge of it. Why is the question on the minds of political analysts and political scientists around the world? I put a lot of emphasis on the following factors. First of all, I think there have been glacial changes in the nature of the global economy and in the nature of national economies that have led to increasing concentrations of wealth, very dramatically increasing concentrations of wealth, and rising inequality and rising income insecurity among a lot of people from the kind of middle class, lower middle class, working class. And, you know, we know from the work of the great social scientists of the previous generation, including my mentor, Seymour Martin Lipset, that when middle class and working class people who've come to depend on a certain level of economic security and a certain level of comfort and has taken that for granted, when they suddenly enter into insecurity, job loss, competition, they often look for scapegoats. And it's unfortunately very easy for political charlatans to point to their insecurity and say, the problem is not these abstract social and economic forces. I mean, in the end, who can really understand robotization, right? Artificial intelligence displacing jobs and globalization and so on, and the global, changing global division of labor. It's much easier to say the Mexicans are coming and they're taking your jobs, or the Algerians are coming in France and they're, shredding your social safety net because they don't really deserve all of these income supplements. It's very easy to play on and identify outsiders and say the problem is them. And so then we have, as a second factor, and I think the ignition switch for this rise of illiberal populism in Europe and the United States, the surge in immigration. And I think the absolute trigger for this was the Syrian refugee crisis that hit Europe in 2016. And the extremely idealistic and generous response from the German Chancellor, Angela Merkel, which I sympathize with as a human being, and I think was a colossal mistake for her politically, for her and for Europe. Because you saw the reaction, and the reaction is still unfolding in terms of the right-wing, illiberal, I'd say with neo-Nazi overtones, Alternative for Germany still gaining at the polls and almost emerging as the largest single party in one of the former East German states in elections in recent days. So that's the second thing.
So the first one is the economics, and I think it's appropriate that you then also talk about your recessions and depressions, right, and expansions, okay, in economic,
fine,
terms, so it
will,
makes sense. Second is immigration,
okay,
and you used Germany and the, okay, Syrian example as a.
Then, I mean, I won't go on with the laundry list, but the third and fourth factors I have to mention are kind of more international.
Yes.
One of the things we learned, I think, from the study of the last big wave of democratic change that, as I said, started in the mid-1970s and went on through the early 2000s, what the late Harvard political scientist Samuel Huntington called the third wave of global democratization, is how important the international community is in facilitating or discouraging democratic progress in the world. And something happened internationally in the early 2000s, actually two things that I think had a profound impact. One was the U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003, which I talked about when I was promoting a different book in this room, 14 years ago. And what the U.S. invasion of Iraq did was the following. When President Bush did not find weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, what could he fall back on to justify the intervention except the idea that we were promoting democracy in Iraq? We'd gotten rid of a tyrant, and we did. Awful man, awful regime. And we were going to help the Iraqis build democracy. That didn't work out very well. And there, you know, it was a hugely costly venture. There were a lot of mistakes wrapped up in it that we probably don't have the time to talk about here. But I refer you to my other book, Squandered Victory. And there was, as a result, there was, we can show this with public opinion data in Europe and the United States, a very significant and I think long-lasting public reaction against the words democracy promotion. And so the idea that Europe and the United States should be spending treasure to promote democracy no longer elicited the level of support that it had once had. And while if you say to people, should we, you know, spend our development assistance dollars and use our diplomacy to help people achieve or improve democracy, they'll say yes. When you mention democracy promotion, they think of invasion and force. And it took some of the wind out of the sails of a more forward-leaning policy. And I'm sorry to say it, but this retreat, I think, from a more forward-leaning policy, which is ongoing now, began under President Obama. Actually, it began under President Bush, who pulled away from his own very lofty and overextended ambitions. But it accelerated under Obama, who was a president that was deeply admiring of and idealistic about human rights, but also had a very strong pragmatic instinct and was very honest in saying that he had a lot of admiration for the realistic, limited foreign policy of President Bush. Not President George W. Bush, but his father, President George Herbert Walker Bush. And so that was the third thing. I think Europe and the United States pulling back from democracy support, democracy assistance, a more forward-leaning strategy for trying to use their resources and leverage to advance and support democracy in the world. And the fourth is just this huge global power shift as a result of the rise of China and the resurgence of Russia and the retreat of Europe and the United States. And now it's the authoritarian regimes that I think have the energy and momentum in the world.
Well, those are significant factors. And since you ended up on the global power shift, and we talk about this change in geopolitical structures, ones that we feel on a daily basis, whether we're buying Chinese goods or listening to the rhetoric coming from the White House, there are some very pressing issues that are now facing these democratic trends and raising these ill winds. You mentioned two of them in your title. Actually, you mentioned three of them in your subtitle, America being the third. But one of them, of course, is Russian rage. The second is Chinese ambition. Maybe we can unpack those two because they fall under that global power shifting fourth point.
I mean, you understand this well. You've written a book about global propaganda and global messaging. The Russians have mastered. The Russians didn't invent disinformation, of course. It's a time-honored tradition, as you know, among states and actors. And they didn't begin doing it themselves in this era. The whole Soviet era, as you note, was an era rife with false information and misleading propaganda efforts to discredit the West. But they got a lot of good computer scientists and social media people in Russia, and I'll just say parenthetically, the tragedy about Russia is I actually think Russia could kind of be like Israel. It could be a really significant innovator and developer of, you know, of positive or benign applications of social media and artificial intelligence if the government leadership decided to apply the national expertise in that direction.
They need DARPA.
Yeah, well, but they're using all this knowledge and skill
yes.
for very backward-looking and revanchist purposes. And so Putin is obsessed with fear, again, as you know, that there'll be a color revolution in his country on his watch. He lives in fear of the mobilization of his own people, which is why he's cracking down on the new generation of youth protesters in the streets of Russia.
And you mentioned these color revolutions because he experienced them certainly nearby,
right,
in Georgia and in Ukraine.
Exactly. And he, you know, when the parliamentary elections happened in Russia in 2011, and there were protests of the fraud, and Hillary Clinton came out with this statement, a very good statement as Secretary of State, you know, expressing concern about this. I think it was a restrained statement, but still it was there. He freaked out, and he thought the U.S. was, you know, embarked on a campaign to encourage this and overthrow him. And he decided he'll act first in terms of sabotaging our political system before we might be, you know, confident enough and resolute enough to do something to dislodge him. And, you know, everybody in this room has read or read about the Mueller report and the other testimonies, which I detail in the book, about what Russia did in the 2016 election campaign to interfere in our campaign and to create an environment of distrust and cynicism and doubt about the political system, about the legitimacy of the electoral process, and to try and foment divisions. They actually had Russian social media trolls pretending to be black activists and pretending to be racist opponents of African American mobilization. And trying to mobilize counter demonstrations in the same city. That's how sick this was. And I think even more than all of the poisonous social media messaging that the Kremlin unleashed through the Internet Research Agency and targeted very precisely into the campaign. And keep in mind that the president's campaign manager, the current president, Paul Manafort, handed over the whole polling data of the Trump campaign to a Russian intelligence operative. That was established, you know, quite some time ago in Mueller's investigation. Even more than that, I think the theft and systematic release through, you know, the WikiLeaks platform of these sensitive documents for the Democratic Party completely changed the momentum of the campaign. I've come to the conclusion, our former Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, has come to the conclusion, one of the leading communications specialists on American politics in the United States, in her book, Kathleen Hall Jamieson, has come to the conclusion that without the Russian intervention in the 2016 campaign, the Republicans would not have won the 2016 presidential election.
So there you have it. The Russians are active. Their rage is expressing itself through these technological, advanced, and focused means. They have had an effect. That effect is disputed, of course, across the party lines. But the fact that they have done it is not disputed. The fact that they have attempted to delegitimize our processes in the United States and to raise questions about our democracy within our own populace has been successful.
Right.
So let's jump from Russia, because Russia also has its own democratic domestic issues. We are looking at an autocratic state. We are looking at really a singular person who runs
right.
everything,
right.
and that is Putin. And so what happened there? How did that sort of shift from the optimism that we had early on during the early days of, well, after the Soviet Union effectively dissolved, into what we now could call Putinism?
I think the answer is fairly simple, actually. Russia, after the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, went through an economic depression that was far more severe than the Great Depression in the United States. And this happened, this dramatic, shattering, humiliating collapse in life circumstances of most Russian citizens happened at the same time that Russia collapsed as a significant power in the world and as a country, then, of course, in the form of the larger Soviet Union, as a country that mattered in the world and that people kind of deferred to in the world. And it's very important never to underestimate, and I hope I don't in this book, how important identity is as a motivator in politics. People derive their a significant dimension of their sense of well-being, their sense of self-worth from the stature and respect that they see their group to be accorded, whether in their society or their whatever realm of social interaction they have, or in international affairs. And when their personal economic circumstances were collapsing, at the same time that the country that they identified with had been brought to its knees and humiliated, and was a kind of beggar on the international stage, and then they saw this small, narrow class of new private sector elites, if you can call it private sector, because it was a very distorted manifestation of it, getting fabulously wealthy by essentially, in the words of the American political scientist Stephen Skolnick, stealing the state. It was just too much, and it created a tremendous backlash and a desire for a strong man that would, I choose my words very carefully here, make Russia great again. And so then you had a president of Russia, Boris Yeltsin, who was, by the later stages of his rule in Bill Clinton's second term, a really serious, crippled alcoholic who was, you know, just barely functioning. There was corruption all around him, including in his family. The family wanted to protect itself from retribution and prosecution. And so they found this guy who'd been a former KGB agent and plucked him out of his office as deputy mayor of St. Petersburg, and then made him prime minister. And then when Yeltsin couldn't go on anymore, he inherited the presidency and turned out to be one of the, I think, most skillful autocrats of modern times.
So you talk about the humiliation and that we shouldn't underestimate culture and identity. China has, and says itself, has gone through a century of humiliation in the international stage. It has not had these economic challenges that the former Soviet Union, contemporary Russia has had. In fact, close to hundreds of millions of people have been drawn out of poverty. What is it about China then today that fits into your framework to say that they are now changing and that there are now these chill ill winds coming from Beijing when they don't have these previous conditions?
Well, I will say two things. Number one, I think there's an obvious big difference between Russia and China. Russia is the danger emanating from an authoritarian model that's been failing. China is the danger that's been emanating from an authoritarian model that's been succeeding and is no longer a rising superpower. It has risen. It is, I'd say, certainly a peer competitor to the United States in Asia, and I think increasingly will represent a competitive threat in the economic front, on the national security front, to the United States and democratic alliances around the world.
And this is what you refer to as Chinese ambition now.
Yes. And so now the continuing with the way in which China differs, first of all, China is still a communist state in contrast to Russia. And it's got a Leninist structure of power in the Communist Party and a United Front organization which has as its goal and has been exercising as its purpose for decades the penetration of democratic societies and the cultivation of friendly ties and relationships. And these have proceeded to the point, as you well know, because you were part of our working group at the Hoover Institution on Chinese influence activities in the United States, where you know, we have to worry about the autonomy, integrity, and so on of our institutions, our think tanks, our local governments in the U.S. and other Western democracies, our corporations, our mass media, where most of the Chinese language mass media in the United States is now spouting a Beijing-friendly line, and much of it has been bought up by people sympathetic to Beijing or actors, you know, really from the mainland. And, you know, the freedoms we take for granted in the United States, I'd say, are coming under challenge in the United States and other Western democracies as a result of this. And then you add the layer, which the Trump administration has rightly, in my view, been extremely concerned about and has resolved to push back against, of relentless theft by the People's Republic of China of our high technology in artificial intelligence, supercomputing, robotics, drone technology, and a variety of other areas that are dual-use technologies and that are not only being applied for commercial advantage, but are being immediately plowed back into the modernization of the People's Liberation Army. The one additional element, Marcos, that I wanted to add to this is I think there is a sense in which we may be looking over the horizon at the possibility of some new similarities between China and Russia, in the sense that the economy is slowing down in China. I think it's slowing down very dramatically, and that they're overestimating by at least 2 percentage points a year their annual economic growth. It's an aging society, as Russia is, in part because of this communist-enforced sterilization and one-child policy for several decades. And it's got a lot of structural flaws and vulnerabilities in the banking sector, the overbuilt urban real estate market, and so on and so forth. We can't dismiss the possibility that there's actually going to be a really serious economic crisis in China. The only thing sustaining the legitimacy of the Chinese Communist Party now is this merry-go-round that keeps revolving at dizzying speed of rapid economic growth. If that goes, how is the Chinese Communist Party going to legitimate its rule? Probably through aggressive nationalism. And then if you're Taiwan, if you're the Philippines, if you're anybody on the perimeter of the South China Sea, not to mention Hong Kong, you'd better be really seriously worried.
And certainly that nationalism is something which has been prominent in the contemporary Chinese society. You see the ramping up within its own media and also within its teachings within the schools of this nationalist message. So there is... they are laying the groundwork for whatever it is that may be coming.
I think that they are doing that. I think that is exactly right. And I think a lot of it is just welling up spontaneously, that there is a legitimate pride in what China has achieved. It's really quite remarkable. There is a feeling of liberation from this history you spoke of, the century of humiliation, which weighs very heavily on every generation of Chinese, older Chinese and younger Chinese. And there is a desire, again, this identity element to be, to quote Jesse Jackson, to be somebody. Well, they all want to be somebody, but they want China as the middle kingdom to be somebody again, you know, to matter in the world and be respected in the world. And we proceed at our peril as a country and as a Western alliance if we don't recognize that. So we certainly don't want to do anything to push back, which I think we need to do, in the South China Sea on technology theft and on inappropriate influence. We don't want to do anything that would disrespect China as a country, the Chinese people, the Chinese culture, or the fact that they're the second largest economy in the world now. Someday they'll be the largest. And actually, they do have the right to play a significant role in world affairs.
We've been hearing from Larry Diamond. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's focused on the causes of democracy's retreat worldwide. After the break, we'll discuss the reforms needed to save liberal democracy. You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. It is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. I'm Jane Wales, your host. We're hearing from Larry Diamond. He's a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he's the author of the new book, Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. Moderating the program is my co-host, Marcus Kunalakis. To hear this broadcast or any other World Affairs program, you can download our podcasts on our iTunes channel or wherever you get your podcasts. Search for World Affairs, that's one word. And now back to our program.
Within this context, you also get the sense out of Beijing that they see themselves as not merely a competitor of these other major geopolitical players, but actually they see themselves as a model to be replicated. And this is part of what your warnings are about, is that in fact this autocratic model that is a top-down in this case Xi Jinping heavy is something that they want to export, and they're planning on exporting that not only with their Belt and Road project, for example, economically, but also from their on an ideological basis.
I think this is actually a new element. One of the quotes that we encountered in our working group and in the report on Chinese influence activities that I think you will remember as I do is this famous quote from Deng Xiaoping after he consolidated his power in the late 1970s. And that is kind of, in essence, lower your head and bow your time. Abide your time. Keep a low profile. Don't be so visible and pushy on the international stage. And be patient until China is fully ready to rise as a global power. And that kind of defined China's international behavior really through Hu Jintao until Xi Jinping's rise. I think Xi Jinping is a different personality as a leader, but he's also come to power at a different time in world history, a time of much greater power for the People's Republic of China than it's ever had. And so we are seeing China behaving on the international stage culturally, normatively, much more assertively than ever before, both to try and reshape norms, including norms about internet freedom and human rights in the UN system, and in terms of now trying to actually tout their model as the best model, as the most desirable model, and to do a little bit of what Putin has been doing to challenge the very model of liberal democracy. That just didn't happen much before under previous Chinese leaders. And I think that there are two reasons for this. One is a growing sense of power and pride for the Chinese People's Republic of China, so that now they have the ability to shape the world in their image. But the second thing is, I think the People's Republic of China, like Vladimir Putin's Russia, live in fear, in constant suffocating fear that what happened to other authoritarian regimes, be it Ukraine and Georgia, as you mentioned, or Mubarak in Egypt and so on, will happen to them, either through a color revolution or a people power revolution or some sudden paroxysm of mass mobilization of frustration and dissent. And they do not want, neither of them, any more examples of successful popular mobilization for democracy. They want to lock into place all the authoritarian regimes that exist in Venezuela, where they're now working very hard, both Russia and China, to shore up this horrific regime under Maduro, in Sudan and elsewhere in the world where the fat is in the fire in terms of popular struggles for democracy. They just don't want any more success stories. And we were talking about this earlier. This is why I'm so worried about Hong Kong. I just don't see Xi Jinping allowing the people of Hong Kong to emerge from this struggle with anything that could be interpreted as a success story.
Well, that brings us to our audience. And in fact, Matthew, who's in our audience, asks about the recent events in Hong Kong and how do they matter and related to democracy and authoritarianism in China and around the world.
So I know we've both written about this recently, and it's kind of hard not to pay attention to it. It's really one of the great and truly inspiring stories of democratic mass mobilization of our time. And I have a lot of friends there in the midst of it. What worries me about the democracy movement in Hong Kong is two things. Number one, that it is very disorganized and lacking in leadership. And number two, that it has been unable to discipline and restrain its ranks in terms of the use of violence. I can tell you that one of the most powerful statistical and analytic generalizations we have in political science scholarship on democratization is that the odds of successful democratization decline, or I'd say successful mobilization for anything, decline significantly when a movement turns toward violence. Significantly. Because you alienate some of the people you'd want to bring to your ranks, and you kind of drive the opposition into the trenches. You unify the opposition, whereas you should want to split them apart. And I think what the movement needs now is two things. Number one, to identify some leaders who can negotiate with the Hong Kong chief executive, Carrie Lam, who has recently made a stunning concession in terms of with not just kind of suspending, but now doing what the demonstrators asked for, withdrawing this utterly odious bill, which started the whole thing, that would have enabled anybody to be extradited to Beijing upon Beijing's request, anybody from Hong Kong, anybody in Hong Kong, including potentially me. So I felt like I had a little bit of a stake in this. And she's made another concession potentially about the issue of policing. So I think they need to, it can't be all mobilization and all demands. Successful movements have to have the capacity for discipline and negotiation as well. So I'm just praying that they can develop that.
One of our questioners says many Western countries have become willing collaborators of China to spread misinformation, for example, on Taiwan sovereignty, transfer of technology, and censorship. What can be done about that?
So on the media front, I think we have to demand really rigorous transparency. I think that Taiwan is extremely vulnerable right now. I worry about its future. And I think that we, the United States, we, the people of the United States and our government, need to shore up and defend our corporations, because the strategy of the People's Republic of China is, you recall what happened with the airlines when one airline or several, you know, on their list of destinations, yes, listed it as Taiwan and not Chinese Taipei, like in the Olympics. And I think we just need to defend our corporations to buck them up so they don't have to buckle under to pressure from the Chinese Communist Party. And the way that Leninist United Front tactics work in part in these issues is to divide and conquer. You know, they'll curry favor with one group and punish another group. The second group is isolated. They don't want to be left out on the cold in terms of relations with the increasingly lucrative Chinese market, increasingly powerful Chinese Communist Party state. So then they cave in too. And what I think American and European and Japanese and so on institutions need to do is ally together and develop some common standards and principles so that the game of divide and rule can't be prosecuted that way.
One of the questioners asks, to what degree are the forces you're looking at in Russia or in China also impacting the European Union? And the question is the post-World War II order of democratic European states also at risk? And I think the answer is probably...
I think that's a great question.
Yes.
And the fact that it could even be asked,
yes,
in a serious way in this year, 2019, I think is really alarming. Mm-hmm. Look, if Boris Johnson succeeds in his effort to evoke a hard Brexit, you know, if Britain crashes out, Scotland's probably going to crash out of the United Kingdom. And you could see a lot of fissiparous tendencies in Europe. You know, Putin has definitely been funding secessionist efforts elsewhere in Europe. He'd like to see nothing better than more countries, more movements seceding from their existing countries, and the European Union collapsing. And most of all, his most precious goal is to break apart and destroy NATO, the most successful military alliance in world history. And if, you know, unfortunately, if you look at what Russia has been doing to modernize its air force, unbelievably, its nuclear forces and a lot of its strike forces and so on, and you look at the way Putin has been pressuring neighbors like Georgia and Ukraine, with the Baltics being so exposed and so vulnerable, this is not a time to be, you know, breaking apart this alliance that has kept Europe, you know, secure from potential Russian or Soviet aggression.
To the United States, and one of the questioners asks, this is a political question, if in 2020 Trump loses the election but claims it was rigged and refuses to step down from the presidency, what is likely to happen? I know it's a great hypothesis, but, you know, it's one of those things that we talk about in cocktail parties, this question of whether or not there needs to be such an overwhelming loss for President Trump in the reelect for him to recognize, in fact, that the election was legitimate.
I don't know what President Trump will do or say tomorrow or the next day, not to mention the day after the election in November of 2020. But I want to say two things. First of all, if the president is defeated in his bid for reelection by anything more than the kind of narrow margin that would trigger a legitimate recount, because it's a narrow margin, let's say hypothetically, in a state that would flip the Electoral College if it went in the other direction, well, then either side has a legitimate right to request a recount, right? But if it's that, you know, he lost by 77,000 votes in three states that account for the victory of the Democratic Party in the Electoral College, I think the president can say and do whatever he wants if it's challenged in the courts, even courts where he's appointed the federal court judges and where he appointed many of the Supreme Court justices. I believe the judiciary will enforce our laws and our norms, and you know, he will be required to leave office, and the moving trucks will be there on January 20th.
It's great to hear your belief in the institutions and the structures and the resilience.
But
of the
have
society.
A darker thing.
Okay, and then we'll go to the lighter part of the evening.
And this is what I'm worried about. In 2016, Vladimir Putin, and I say this metaphorically, I don't mean him literally, but the intelligence operatives and extended digital apparatus that he had mobilized was, we now know, as a result of the release of a recent Senate Intelligence Committee report, inside the voter registration databases and digital architectures, not of 24 states, which had initially been reported, but of 50 American states. There's no evidence that the Russians did anything, but they managed to get inside the system. I don't think if Russia does this again in 2020, which I think it's fully planning to do, and which the Trump-appointed director of the FBI, Christopher Wray, has warned it is preparing to do, and which leaders of the intelligence agencies, including the recently departed director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, appointed by President Trump, has warned they're preparing to do. I think if the Russians re-enter the voter registration databases of the states in the United States, they're not going to kind of pay a friendly reconnaissance visit and leave. I think that the purpose of their entering the next time, and possibly the purpose of the reconnaissance this time, is going to be to change in a much more visceral and direct way the outcome of the 2020 presidential election. And it isn't hard to do. You don't need to have the sophisticated knowledge of the American electorate that by now, after 6 years of being at this, the Kremlin has acquired, to know which names, you know, every fourth or fifth one on which precincts, which Hispanic-sounding names, which African-American names in certain precincts, or which names in certain college towns, in Madison, Wisconsin, for example, to knock off the voter register so that they can't vote on election day. And then we've got the situation in the United States where we have about 14 states using, at least as some of their voting machines, machines that are so antiquated that they don't meet the minimal test of integrity that every computer scientist in the United States says is essential for having a democratic election. And that is a machine that can produce an auditable paper trail of how people voted so that there can be a recount or an audit of the vote. And then you have one state, a state where we already know we have problems with electoral integrity, Georgia, where none of the voting machines leave a paper trail. And there is just nothing that is more important for the future of American democracy, no single thing, than ensuring that our system of voting is impervious to this kind of manipulation and subversion, which I think is a real possibility. People in Congress of both political parties have been begging the United States Congress to pass legislation to provide more funding for the states, to modernize their equipment, to provide new authority for and a mandate for the Department of Homeland Security to provide assistance to the state and county electoral administration infrastructures, and nothing is happening. And the vital legislation, you know, some of it entirely innocuous, is now being held up by one man, the Senate Majority Leader. And I just can't fathom why any person who is concerned about American democracy would block this legislation. He's going to say it's too expensive. My God, look at what has happened to the federal deficit in the United States. They've just thrown money at all their differences to on both sides of the political aisle to just get things done. So what's another $500 million to $1 billion to safeguard American democracy?
That was dark, Larry, and concerning. And one of the things I've always appreciated about you is your passion about this subject, because it is real and it is something that affects us on a daily basis. But I'm not going to let you get out of here without talking about what can we look forward to. I'll give you an example. One of the questioners this evening suggests that public service, a universal public service, is something that would be helpful. Expanding things like AmeriCorps. I know that you have a laundry list of things that we can try to do in this country. First and foremost, since you've raised it, we have to fix our electoral system and make sure that there is integrity. Okay, that's number one. But what do we do sort of on a daily basis and as a society to deal with some of these issues that you've raised?
Okay, well, I'll just hit a few bullet points. I think that the single most important thing we need to do medium term is address the pathologies in our democratic institutions. And the one that I think can be most successfully addressed, and that I believe is achievable in the coming years, is fixing our electoral system in a different sense. And that is not in the sense of the administration of the voting, but in terms of the rules that decide who gets elected to office. Right now in the United States, almost all offices are filled through something we call first past the post. Doesn't matter how many people run, it doesn't matter what percentage of the vote they get, whoever gets the most votes wins. And I think this system, interacting with our system of nominating candidates in very low turnout party primaries, is a major contributing factor to our dysfunction and polarization. Because you were mainly getting, you can show this statistically, as I will show the class statistically tomorrow morning, my class is here, that you were mainly getting the Republican Party moving much further to the right in Congress over the last two decades than the Democrats were moving to the left. I do believe now you're seeing more of a symmetrical process, and it's the same logic. The people who are most passionately involved, most ideologically committed, are the ones most likely to turn out in low turnout party primaries, where you're lucky if you get 20% of the electorate total to turn out in a primary. If you had ranked choice voting in the United States, as San Franciscans are well familiar with because they've been using it to elect their mayor, then if your favorite candidate didn't make it, your vote would be transferred to your second choice if no one got a majority. This makes a difference because it's going to free up now independents and people from other parties to run and be taken seriously, because people can vote for them and not waste their vote. If their first choice doesn't make it, their vote is transferred to their second choice and keeps being transferred until somebody wins. And if we can break this dynamic of polarization, I think we can start getting things done on infrastructure spending, on DACA, on healthcare, on other aspects of immigration, on all sorts of things where it's now just a pitched battle between Republicans and Democrats with kind of zero-sum warfare on Capitol Hill. And I just personally think I've come to this conclusion a long time ago. It's just no way to govern. We need more fluidity in the political process, and we need to liberate politicians who fear being defeated in a party primary from this fear by saying, you know, we'll have the more center-leaning and fluid elements of ranked choice voting. And if you're defeated in a primary, you should be free to come back and run in a general election as an independent, and maybe people will value you for your independence. I think where you want a positive here, this system was adopted by voter initiative in Maine in 2016. They had to go back and do it again because the political establishments mobilized against it, but they did. It's being probably going to get on the ballot in Massachusetts in 2020. And there are other American states now that are where there's grassroots mobilization for this. There's a bill in the California State Senate now that you may be aware of that would give all municipal jurisdictions in California the authority to experiment and choose whatever electoral system they want for their own municipal elections and move California, I think, more decidedly in this election, this direction. And the other thing that I'm optimistic about is other voter initiatives that are passing now, I'd say with growing frequency and growing grassroots campaigns to address and fix a lot of our problems. Gerrymandering has been eliminated in a number of states by voter initiative, with California being in a leading role about, 9 years ago now. But other states have been acting in this regard to eliminate gerrymandering and give the power to draw legislative district boundaries to independent commissions. Florida, which is not exactly a raging blue state in terms of its voting behavior, voted last November to give nonviolent convicted felon offenders to restore their franchise, their right to vote. And there are laws against, you know, to tighten up lobbying at the state level that are being passed by voter initiatives. So I think we're actually entering a new progressive era where there's a lot of reform energy welling up from the grassroots, as happened in the last progressive era a century ago. And I think it's going to be a very creative and exciting time for the renewal of American democracy.
Well, Larry, thank you for bringing us back, because we were all on the brink for a moment there. Yeah. I know that you're not as optimistic about other places necessarily, but you do have in your book, Ill Winds, some interesting looks at individuals and heroes in these various countries who are standing up to these powers that be, who are fighting the good fight, who are promoting democracy within their own societies and at great personal risk. I want to say this brings us to the end of our radio listeners portion, so I want to thank all those radio listeners for tuning in.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a nonprofit membership organization, and we're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This program featured Larry Diamond. He's senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and he's the author of the new book, Ill Winds, Saving Democracy from Russian Rage, Chinese Ambition, and American Complacency. This program was moderated by my co-host, Marcus Kunalakis. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio and the Aspen Institute. Our technical supervisor is Jim Bennett. Our researcher is Claire McMahon. Our producer is Jared Sport. And our executive producer is Laura Beatty. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.